Before we begin today's show, I have some important news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June the 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $94,000 by that date. The great news is generous friends of the ministry have offered a new $5,000 matching grant, which will double your gift today up to that amount. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I am very excited to be joined today by Dr. Crystal Hurd, an educator, poet and researcher from Virginia. She's contributed a chapter on Flora Lewis, C.S. Lewis's mum, in the book Women and C.S. Lewis. And she's written her own book, The Leadership of C.S. Lewis, 10 Traits to Encourage Change and Growth. We're going to be talking about Crystal's work on various aspects of C.S. Lewis's life, as well as sharing a paper that was presented on her behalf at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Crystal's paper there was How Paternal Literary Habits Influenced C.S. Lewis. Crystal, we've spoken about Flora, the impact of Flora on C.S. Lewis, but what was life like for C.S. Lewis's father, Albert, growing up?
His father was a shipbuilder and in Cork, and that's where he started the reading room for the workers. We do have some of Richard's speeches. We have two or three of those, and they're all Christian in nature, sort of talking about the importance of, you know, being a good worker. You know, there's that Victorian ideal of, you know, your work is also honored by God, even if it's not like, even if it's a secular job, right? God honors your work. So you need to have your duty and you need to do your job and do it the best of your ability. Don't shirk your responsibilities, things like that. So Richard was actually responsible for starting and instituting a reading room among all the workers in the shipbuilding company he was working for. And it went for a couple years. And most of it's really interesting because Albert had a very different destiny than all of his other brothers. He had a sister that we don't really hear much about. She kind of split from the family early, so we don't see much of her. But he had brothers that ended up moving to Scotland and starting a rope business. So when he talks about his Scottish uncles, those are the guys that he mentions. But that family was, very working class, very close. Albert was the baby. So he had that same very early, like, intellect and just talent that set him apart from everyone else. And I think even Richard realized from an early age, this kid doesn't need to build ships. He needs to go do something substantial. Not that that's not substantial, but, like, you know, and Belfast is actually where they built the original Titanic, right? But as they say, if you go there, we just built the ship. We let the English drive it. that's the joke they say. No offense. That's what they said when I went there the first time. Said we built it. It was fine, right? That shipyard. What happened was Richard eventually moved his family to Belfast because that's a shipyard, so there was more work available. And eventually he opens up his own business. So he and Richard and McIlwain, so it's McIlwain and Lewis, start building ships. There was another Titanic built in that port, but it was fine. No obstacles there. It went for years. I think that was like McElwain and Lewis helped build that one or something, but it was great. No icebergs or anything, but, they worked together for a little while and then the business, fell apart. A lot of biographies have wondered why that is. Based on what I've seen in the Lewis papers, there was a tiff between McElwain and Richard Lewis, and there seems to be a perception that McElwain thought he was better than Lewis. And again, this might be the working class mind too. You know, when sometimes you feel like people think lesser of you because you're working class or something, and that's definitely something that Albert had in mind because he worked his tail off to become what he became. But eventually the business fell apart and then eventually Richard would retire. But they stayed in Belfast and worked there. So again, we don't hear much about the mother. We just have some letters. But Albert was in Dublin. He would travel. He was learning. He was a little sponge. He was going places, absorbing things, reading as much as he could because he wanted a different life for himself. He is the bootstrap, Charles Dickens-esque type of character, right? He's the guy who said, I'm going to change my destiny. I'm going to work hard. And then when he got that destiny, he continued to work hard because then he felt responsible, you know, for all these people he was, you know, because honestly, he could have been a great politician, but his conscience wouldn't allow it. We have stories of Albert kicking people out of his office because they wanted him to, I guess, fib or do some not quite legal stuff with the law. And his law clerk says, you know, he would hear Albert yell, you want me to be a fraud? Get out of here. And would literally kick them out of his office. So, you know, here's a man who, you know, just like we were talking in the leadership podcast, had that moral compass and stayed true to his principles, even as he rose in rank. Last month, I got to go to Belfast and I got to visit Royal Avenue, which is where his office was, which was cool. Now it's just other stuff. I mean, because it's been a while. It's been, almost 200 years since he's been there. But it was so neat to walk down the middle of Belfast where the city center is, right? And that's where Albert went to work every day. You know, this is, how cool is that? I mean, can you imagine like being this shipbuilder's son, right? And all your brothers are working class and, you know, running their little businesses. And then you walk up into this beautiful building with this big, tall Queen Victoria, you know, statue in front of it and all these great, like, you know, these, like, there's a part of it too that almost kind of looks Greek, right? With these columns and stuff. I mean, it's this beautiful landmark, really, in the middle of this town that's been through so much. And I was blown away by, I guess, the juxtaposition of like the old and the new, because a lot of the, I guess, former like military arts and stuff has been covered up with new art about sort of unifying and the beauty of art. So you could walk down the street and there's murals of, you know, all these beautiful things that's covering up all this old stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it just shows how the town itself has evolved. But to see the Belfast city center, right, and be on the same streets that he walked down was just such a cool experience. And it was so cool. And I got to pay respect at their grave. And, you know, it wasn't lost on me, you know, standing in front of Flora's grave that here were these young boys, you know, years ago, watching this heap of earth swallow up their mother. And there's so many things you don't understand at that age, but you know grief, and you know hurt. And So being there at that time was really important. But, you know, Albert was a huge success, and they made cartoons of him. They wrote poems about him. Like, he was in the paper all the time. And when he passed, his obituary was incredibly beautiful and poignant about the sacrifices and all the things he did for the city. He really was a servant of the people.
Mm.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a new $5,000 matching grant that will double your gift today up to that amount. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as there is a final funding gap of $94,000 that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June the 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to please give your very best gift right now to close this gap, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Well, Crystal, we're going to hear much more in your paper about both Richard and Albert's love of literature. But do we have any idea what triggered Richard's passion for reading? I mean, was it unusual for a working class labourer to be as voracious a reader as Richard Lewis was?
Well, that's interesting, because if you've looked at Victorian history, they talked about a lot of the working class would trip over, you know, your typical vices, alcohol, you know, ladies of ill repute, you know, those types of things. But during that, I think that second part of the Victorian era, there was this push for, I guess, a more moral workforce, right? And part of that was to emphasize the church's role in society. And for people, you know, if I'm a business owner, right, I would want to hire a worker who's dedicated, who's, you know, supporting their family, who's doing all that. So it actually, if you were a worker during that time and you did have, a church, if you were a church member and you were reading, right, instead of drinking, right, or other vices, that actually looked really well on you. You were actually seen as a contributing citizen of the larger culture. To read was to educate yourself and to improve yourself. So a lot of workers around that time actually decided to do that, not just for self-improvement, but to also show the administration above them, their bosses, you know, that they were, you know, good moral people. So I don't really know, because I don't have much past Richard as far as going back.
Yeah.
But we do have a fragment of a children's story he wrote for his children, and which I mentioned in the paper, Timothy Tumbledown. And it's a fragment. We only have like chapter two. But it's Richard writing a story for his children to enjoy. So C.S. Lewis is not the first person to write a children's story.
And then Richard obviously passed on his love of literature to his son, Albert. I mean, do we know much about what Albert read and how that was significant in terms of influencing Warney and C.S. Lewis?
Yes. So Albert's, and I think his time, even though it was short at Lurgan and some of these schools he went to, I think, like I said, he was a little sponge. He knew, here's what I need. Now, his grades weren't that great, okay? but they were okay. But like I said earlier, you know, Kirkpatrick said there's something of the divine fire in you. There's just something in you that makes you different and unique and makes you valuable. to society. So I think Albert recognized that too. And again, you know, like his son, right? He could have been a politician and said, yeah, sure, I'll compromise on my values to get ahead and, you know, do this and that. But he chose not to. He literally stopped that path in his life and said, I'm just going to serve the public as a defender. There's a need here that needs to be done. And so I think Albert chose that way, but he did love the law. In one of the cartoons we have of him, he's actually carrying a book of literature, not of law. So it was well known that he loved novels, loved novels. He loved Dickens, loved Trollope. And Trollope was a local, right? He was from Belfast, right? So like, Trollope, if you've read him, he's great. Really, he's really witty, but he's kind of this nice blend of, you know, church and society and stuff. So that was right up their alley in that house. but, you know, we have, I think, two or three short stories that Albert wrote. One I published in 2020 in Zenzucht, which is the story of the half sovereign. And one was declined by a publication called Titbits. and then there was like a partial one. So there's a lot of fragments because the papers just have everything that they had. But one of his favorite book was a collection of essays for the Edinburgh. It was critical and historical essays by Lord Macaulay. That book, somebody actually mentioned to him early on that he reminded them of Macaulay. Mm. And that is a huge compliment because he was, and I actually have a copy of it.
Oh, wow.
Looky there. This is the American version of the copy that Albert got from his father for Christmas. His father bought him a copy of this for Christmas, I think in 1879. So he was still early. He was still very much molding himself into the man he would become. And so they bought him. He's very distinguished. Look at him, right?
Yes, he is.
But these essays, and there are a lot of them here, are, critical and historical essays contributed to the Edinburgh Review. So what I like about this copy is the pages match, the page numbers match with the one at the Wade, which was Albert's original book.
Wow.
So it was kind of neat when I was at the Wade, I'm reading the Lewis papers and Warney, who kind of narrates the papers, says, oh, my dad's favorite book was this essays by Macaulay. He went to it again and again and again. He made multiple notes in there, multiple. And he made tons of notes. And so it was so neat because at that point I was reading and I looked up at Laura, who's the archivist there. And I said, do you have this book?
Wow.
Right. She went and typed it in and said, yeah, we have it. Do you want me to pull it? Yes.
Yes.
I can't even say yes fast enough. So she pulled it. It was there. It's still there with Albert's original annotations, underlining and notes at the Wade Center. I just wanted to put it in my jacket.
just cuddle it for a bit.
Oh, I mean, it was so cool because the annotations, and I think this is again where C.S. Lewis, you know, annotated his books because he watched his dad do that. And there's underlining, there's parts where he says no, you know, it disagrees with them. And so it was so cool to watch the book that shaped Albert, right?
Mm.
To watch his, you know, look at his annotations and read those and enjoy those. And these essays are on, you know, political issues, literature, Boswell's Life of Johnson's one of the essays in here that was read a lot. So it's honestly like a cultural study with this. I mean, you know, he was actually very well known politician, and I think he was paymaster or something for a while, postmaster or something. But he was very astute. And so that was, like I said, that was Albert's book that his father gave him for Christmas. And that book stayed in his library the rest of his life. And he returned to it over and over again.
Wow.
And Lewis does speak quite explicitly about the impact of all of these books, doesn't he? I think it's in The Allegory of Love where he says, the greatest of these debts, that which I owe to my father for the inestimable benefit of a childhood passed mostly alone in a house full of books is now beyond repayment. So clearly, for both Lewis and his brother Warney, the fact that there were so many books, I mean, it was probably Flora as well as his their father, but it was a huge impact on them, wasn't it? The fact that they were surrounded by literature.
Yeah, Flora did not like poetry. She was more of a novel gal. and Albert loved all of it and wrote all of it. We have several of Albert's poems. We have some of Hamilton, right? Flora's dad wrote poetry. So we have some of his poems. Not many, but, you know, the few that he wrote during his time in the Navy. So, absolutely. I mean, that house was full to the brim. He talks about Surprised by Joy too deep, right, of books. And Albert never got rid of any of them. They were never restricted from any of it. And I think that took an enormous amount of trust and the boys to read and absorb what they know. But yeah, these essays, like I said, they're critical and historical. So I read this and I think about Warren's great books on French history. And I can definitely see the influence. Yeah.
Crystal, let's talk about Arthur's relationship with Lewis's mother, Flora. Do we know how that began?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a I mean, think of Joy, right? Poor Joy, how she just, you know, had to. Yeah, I mean, I remember in one of the poems that she wrote, right, one of the love sonnets that she wrote for Lewis, this is Joy Davidman, right? She goes, "Oh my Antarctica," right? Because he just wouldn't get into a relationship with her, and she was very much in love with him, and she just felt like, oh, he'll never give in. He'll never surrender. this is exactly what happened with Albert and Flora, but the reverse. Albert, I think, knew pretty early on that he was in love with Flora. I think he just, and she's, who wouldn't? She's awesome. I mean, she's brilliant. She's funny. She's courageous. I mean, she's all these wonderful adjectives. And like I sort of mentioned earlier, she was put off by it. She never considered herself marriage material at that point. She grew up in a family that really kind of dismissed her, neglected her. So she didn't really know what kind of life she would have as a wife. And I don't know if she'd even really considered it all that much. But Albert, God bless him, Albert was so persistent. You know, he would write to her. We have letter after letter after letter where Flora says, listen, please don't think I'm mean, okay? But no. Okay? Like, please, I'm really trying to be nice about this, but I don't love you, okay? And then later as they get into the letters, she does mention, you know, your brother and me did not end on great terms. You know, I'm not really interested in swapping and trying again. you know, and but according to what I've read, because even Albert says in a letter, you know, I can't fix what happened in the past, but we can move forward from that. So it sounds to me like the brother maybe broke it off or something. I don't have an explicit thing on that, but it didn't end well. They did not end well. So, but it sounds to me like Albert always kind of had his eye on her. He does date another girl. We have letters from a teenage Albert to a girl. And Lord, she was very, I don't know, like the whole letters we have are about something that was said at a party. And so Albert has to write like 3 pages explaining why he contextualizing what he said at the party and saying that he didn't mean it in a bad way. And I'm like, you know, anyway, that didn't end well. I guess he was practicing for being a lawyer, right? Defending himself. But, you know, yeah, she kept turning him down. And then finally, and I talk about this in Women and C.S. Lewis, he said, hey, I heard that you published a short story, The Princess Rosetta, in Household Journal. And she's like, oh, yeah, that is not your flavor at all. You know, she writes him, she says, I mean, she says this, you are more interested in more like cognitive, right? Cerebral writing. You're not into this. This is like Reader's Digest. This is just a little story. You wouldn't enjoy it. And he says, try me. Send it my way. So she does, reluctantly, but she does. And what do we get? But this letter, like, exuding so much joy and just telling Flora, oh, you're so, Belfast should be proud to have a writer like you. And we should send it, you know, to the British, yeah, we should send it to the British Museum. And it's just be, and you know what? It worked. So no surprise here, but his parents actually united around literature. He read some of her stuff. He loved it. They start talking about writers they like. They both enjoy John Ruskin. And I'll talk more about that in the Rutledge chapter that I'm working on. But they talk about how much they love. She likes Sesame and Lilies, right? And so they start talking about all these writers. And I mean, 3 or 4 letters later, Flora writes a letter and says, thanks for the ring.
Wow.
Yeah. Once they connected on literature, that was it.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the program. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.